You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. Earlier this month, the League of Women Voters in Asheville, North Carolina, sponsored a 5K run that traced the boundary between the 10th and 11th congressional districts of North Carolina. The point was to show people in a very direct and hands-on, or feet-on-the-ground, I guess, way, how a community can be divided by redistricting, also known as gerrymandering. In that part of the state, the liberal city of Asheville was split into two different congressional districts, both of which had a majority rural Republican population, so the vote of the Democratic citizens of Asheville was diluted to the point where they could not elect a candidate in either district, the 10th or the 11th. This is just one of hundreds of examples of partisan redistricting that have gone on just in this decade, and the effect on our nation's politics and the lives of ordinary citizens is extreme, as you'll hear in just a moment. This is the second program in our series about our own government, what's working, what's not working, and what citizens of all political leanings can do to make it better. Our guest is David Daley. He's the author of the book Rat F***ed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So the secret plan to steal the nation's democracy that you're writing about is, it's all about redistricting, also known as gerrymandering. Gerrymandering goes way back. It was named after a Federalist named Elbridge Gerry in 1812. Tell us very briefly what that was all about.
Absolutely. I mean, as long as we've had politicians, they have tried to manipulate district lines in order to give themselves an advantage. It actually goes back even earlier than poor Governor Gerry from Massachusetts. You can trace it back to Patrick Henry in 1788, trying to screw James Madison out of a seat in the very first Congress. It didn't work very well. It worked much better for Governor Gerry's party. What they did was they attempted to redraw all of the state Senate seats surrounding Boston in that election in such a way as to advantage their side. And indeed, in the next election, the other party won many, many more votes, but Governor Gerry's party took almost three quarters of the seats. When a political cartoonist drew a picture of the map, he thought that the districts resembled a salamander, and you ended up with Governor Gerry going down in political infamy as the inventor of the gerrymander.
The whole topic of redistricting is, as you write, kind of nerdy. It's not really an emotionally exciting topic on the face of it. But you've written this totally riveting book in which the reader feels like, or I felt like, Dr. Watson riding along with Sherlock Holmes, trying to get to the bottom of the story, which is full of secrecy and intrigue and dirty dealing. The main story that you're telling, and that, you know, the history goes back far further than this, but the main story starts around the 2008 election, when President Obama and many other Democrats across the country won elections. A Republican strategist named Chris Jankowski figured out a way to fight back. It was called Red Map. Tell us that story.
It's an amazing story. I mean, if you go back to election night 2008, Democrats had a huge evening. They not only elected Barack Obama president, but Democrats took a supermajority in the U.S. Senate, and they also held on to the U.S. House. If you go back and look at the TV coverage of that night, you see the smartest minds of both sides talking seriously about how the Republican Party was going to be a minority party in this country for a generation to come. Well, it didn't exactly happen that way, did it? And really, the reason is because Jankowski and some other really smart Republican strategists, they understood that while 2008 was an important election and a historic election, that 2010 could potentially be a bigger election. And that's because every 10 years, in years ending in zero after the census, we redraw every state legislative and congressional line in the country in order to account for population changes within a state and between all of the states. So if the Republicans were able to have a big election in 2010, more importantly, if they're able to have a big election in certain key states, they could win every seat at the table when the new lines were drawn in 2011, and they could use redistricting as their path back to power.
And the elections that we're talking about, a lot of them were state legislative elections, like the Pennsylvania or Wisconsin or Florida state houses, which are not to big donors, like super glamorous things to donate to, but they're also a lot less expensive than national races.
That's exactly right. The genius of Red Map is that the Republicans were able to talk their big donors into appreciating the importance and the significance of local elections and the potentially national consequences for them. There's a really amazing op-ed piece that Karl Rove writes in the Wall Street Journal in March of 2010, and he really lays out the entire plan. I mean, Rove says that there are 107 state legislative seats in 16 states that are important for redistricting, and that if the Republicans could win just those 107 local state legislative races, and he lays out what some of them are in Texas and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Indiana, that Republicans could have the power to redraw 193 of the 435 congressional seats completely on their own. What the Republicans understood in 2010 was the connection between winning the state legislative races and then the power the next year to redraw national lines in order to fix the demographic and political problems that the party was facing. They completely reinvented the idea of the gerrymander.
And so the idea was, in a state where the state legislature gets to draw those lines, they would take over the state. Like, give us an example. Pennsylvania was a state where Democrats had been in control.
That's exactly right, except it was super close. In Pennsylvania in 2010, the state house was divided 102 for the Democrats, 101 for the Republicans. It doesn't get much closer than that. Yeah. So what the Republicans did was they targeted in very specific ways a handful of Democratic state representatives, six of them, and they spent about $1 million trying to knock them out of office and to take control of the chamber. It was a highly successful plan. It was driven largely based on, you know, negative ads that were dropped into these local races pretty much entirely in the last 6 weeks of the campaign. So it was too late for these incumbents to be able to respond effectively, that they couldn't possibly raise that much money that quickly. They had no idea it was coming. And by the time the Republicans dropped these bombs into all of these districts, it was simply too late, and they cleaned their clocks. So the following year, Republicans had complete control of the process of drawing new state and congressional lines in Pennsylvania. And as a result, as we're talking in 2017, Republicans now enjoy a 121-81 advantage in the Pennsylvania State House. And they've gone from a 12-7 Democratic congressional delegation to a 13-5 Republican congressional delegation. That's the power of drawing these lines. You see it in 2012 in state after state after state. The lines that the Republicans draw in 2011 become their firewall in 2012, when at a national level, Democrats get 1.4 million more votes for the U.S. House, but Republicans hold on to the chamber 234-201. And they're able to do that in no small part because in a state like Pennsylvania, largely a blue state, a state that went for President Obama that year, they elect 13 Republicans and 5 Democrats. A state like Ohio, 12 Republicans and 4 Democrats. Michigan, 9 Republicans and 5 Democrats, even though almost 250,000 more votes for Democratic candidates. North Carolina is now a 10-3 state. Wisconsin, 5-3. And what you haven't seen is a single one of those swing districts in our swing states swing blue this entire decade. So not in 2012, not in 2014, and not in 2016. All of the swing has been taken out of these districts.
So that our listeners really understand this, I mean, it's important to understand that in states where a lot of the time you have about 50% of the voters voted for Democrats for the House of Representatives. The other 50% voted Republicans. Sometimes it's 51% or 49% or whatever. Right. But if 50% of the voters in Pennsylvania vote for a Democrat, only something like 25 or 30% of their representatives are Democrat. That's how gerrymandering works.
Exactly. You will never have perfectly proportional representation simply because, you know, there's 18 seats in Pennsylvania. So, I mean, if it was 50-50, it's probably not going to go 9-9. But what has become so distorted is the correlation between seats and votes. It's never going to be perfect, but it has gotten so twisted in so many of these states. I mean, Pennsylvania is largely a blue state. It did go for Donald Trump in 2016, but that was the first time that it had gone red since, I believe, 1988 and the first George Bush. So the important thing about Pennsylvania is it's 51 or 52% of the votes only leads to about 28% of the seats. And it's the same in state after state. So in a state like Ohio, 50% of the vote ends up leading to only 25% of the seats. It grossly distorts democracy and it twists up what voters do with the ballot box.
The main way that this is done, because, I mean, listeners are probably scratching their heads now. How can this be? What they do is they pack very large numbers of Democrats into small numbers of districts.
Yes.
So the Democrat in one district might win by 80%, but then all the districts around it are not quite competitive, but they're sort of like 55% Republican, something like that?
That's exactly right. There are two real ways of gerrymandering. There's packing and there's cracking. Packing means that you are trying to cram as many of the other side's votes into as few districts as possible, and they win those districts overwhelmingly, and you take all the surrounding seats. When you crack the other side's votes, you are spreading them as thin as you can across as many districts as possible so that they're not really a majority anyplace. Both of these strategies are highly effective and never more effective than in 2010 and 2011 because of the advent of amazingly sophisticated computer software programs and the kinds of big data about voters that allow these map makers to do precise surgical lines and to do it faster than ever.
Yeah, this is big data, which can be used for good or evil, being used in a pretty nefarious way.
I would say so.
Tell us a little bit more about that. I mean, they can go block by block.
Oh, they most certainly. We think about gerrymandering often as being about kind of, you know, funny lines on a map. Let me assure you, though, that there's nothing funny about it. When these map makers are drawing those lines, they know exactly what the result of putting them there will be. And that's because they know who lives in these houses, and they largely know everything about you, what you buy, and how you vote. And a lot of that information is available in the census. There's a slew of demographic data in the census, and you can upload all of that straight into a map-making program like Maptitude, which is incredibly powerful. But then you can also purchase all kinds of private databases and public record databases and upload all of those in. So voting records, which years did you show up at the polls? Which year did you not show up at the polls? You can take the voting results at a precinct level and cross-tabulate that against voting records and all of the houses. And then you can have a pretty good idea of how everybody in those on those streets actually votes. You can purchase a cloud's worth of consumer preferences, Facebook, social media likes, all of this stuff is purchasable. The exact same strategies by which an ad follows you around the internet or Amazon and Netflix know exactly what you want to buy or watch next can be used by map makers to try and determine which way you vote and where to place these lines. Partisan gerrymandering has always been a lethal weapon. This kind of technology and data makes it all the more deadly. And really, it's the data, the technology, and the ease and the efficiency with which it can be manipulated that makes the post-2010 cycle so fundamentally different from any other in our history.
You illustrate that in a very real way in one of the chapters in your book, in which you actually drive the boundaries of Michigan's 14th congressional district. Tell us about that.
You know, you can actually see the very boundary lines between hope and despair are etched on these streets. And it was really remarkable. I mean, I spent 13 or 14 hours taking that district turn by turn. And it's a wild looking district. Essentially, what its goal is to take the poorest neighborhoods in Detroit and connect them with the African-American city of Pontiac, which is about 30 miles north of Detroit. So it's a winding kind of snake-like district that elects an African-American to Congress, Brenda Lawrence, right now, with about 80 or 85% of the vote. And by packing as many African-Americans and Democrats as possible into that district, that's what allows Michigan to be a 9-5 Republican state. And I wanted to see what it looked like up close. And there are all of these like fascinating squiggles on the map. And the amazing thing was, over the course of the day, every single time there was a squiggle, there was a reason for it. You could see the demographics of these blocks change in front of you in shocking and startling ways. There are a couple of turns in Detroit as you're coming kind of down the northeast piece of this district, where if you take three left turns, you can go in and out of this district three different times, and you can watch the property values deflate from over $500,000 down to about $8,500. It is absolutely amazing to watch and see. You can see the schools over the course of a couple of turns are completely different schools. You know, one of them is run down and looks frightening, and the other has these beautifully manicured playgrounds outside. The demographics that are behind these lines are deeply purposeful and deeply consequential.
And one of the things that is part of this, and we talked to Ari Berman recently about his wonderful book, Give Us the Ballot, which was about the history of the Voting Rights Act. There's something that you call or is called the Unholy Alliance. Tell us what that's about.
Yes. And Ari's book is absolutely terrific and recommended for everybody. The Unholy Alliance really represents the first piece of the Republican gerrymandering strategy. My book really starts in 2010, and it talks about the second piece of it. But in reality, the growth of the solid Republican South in Congress begins in the early 1990s. And it starts when Lee Atwater, who was a very dirty and conniving Republican operative, he runs George H.W. Bush's presidential campaign in 1988, and he takes over the Republican National Committee afterwards. And what he does is he calls in a young lawyer who is his new chief counsel, and he says, we're going to do something about redistricting. That turns out to be Ben Ginsburg, who, as we all know, would go on to become a very powerful Republican election lawyer and run Bush versus Gore and all kinds of things for the GOP. And what Atwater and Ginsburg recognized was that when the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized in the early 1980s by Congress under Ronald Reagan, they included a clause that said you ought to have a majority-minority seat wherever you can in order to aid the concept of African-American representation. Ginsburg and Atwater saw this and they recognized, well, if we create those majority-minority seats, we'd be packing all the Democrats into a couple of districts, and we could take all of the ones around them. And they said, wouldn't it be a whole lot better, though, if instead of this just coming from Republicans, if we could talk African Americans in the South into forming a deal with us? They would get seats. They would get a representation. We would take all of the surrounding seats and control of Congress overall. And that's exactly what happened. So a state like North Carolina or a state like Georgia used to have a lot of white conservative Democrats representing it. By the mid-1990s, by the early 2000s, most of those conservative white Democrats were gone, and those states had largely white conservative Republicans and just a couple of Democrats, largely African-American Democrats. This was called the Unholy Alliance because it was a deal between two sides that probably didn't agree on a whole bunch politically, but they certainly could find overlapping interests as far as their own representation went.
I can't help but wonder, when I read this story, whether the African-American leaders who did gain seats, I mean, legitimately gain, you know, got a lot of people into Congress, did they know that they were being used for Republican partisan purposes?
I think they probably did know that. But I mean, I don't necessarily feel as a 47-year-old white guy that I stand in any position to judge the kinds of deals that they made. I mean, if you believe that those white conservative Democrats aren't representing you very well, and certainly the Democratic Party in the South was not necessarily conducive for African-American interests for a long period of time, and African-Americans represented a huge amount of Democratic voters, but they held essentially no political power. So in 1992, you get the first African-Americans elected in North Carolina to Congress in almost 100 years. In 1994, you have the largest congressional black caucus at any time since Reconstruction in this country. You also, however, have as Speaker Newt Gingrich. So both of these things go hand in hand.
You met the man, the map maker, who drew the lines in the Michigan 14th district that you spent all that time driving the borders of.
Yes.
And he kind of brushed off the idea that there was even a gerrymander at all. And one of the things about this process was that while the basic strategy, take over state legislatures and redraw the lines, was really out in the open, the tactics, the actual tactics, were shrouded in secrecy. And the reader is thinking, this can't be legal. Describe this secretive process and how it was revealed.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, in state after state, you see these incredibly secretive processes. So, I mean, in a state like Ohio, Republican mapmakers barricaded themselves in a suite at the Doubletree Hotel in Columbus. They called it the bunker.
Yeah.
They didn't tell anybody where they were because, politicians in a bunker, only good things can possibly happen in a scenario like that. And when all of the emails came out in court challenges or in Freedom of Information Act requests, you could see what they were up to late at night, talking to one another, usually on their personal Gmail addresses and not on their official accounts. They were doing all kinds of horse trades. They were swapping maps and talking about how they could make them even less competitive by hundreds of a percentage point. You just see the excruciating detail that every single state went through. In a state like Wisconsin, the map makers barricaded themselves into a map room at a law office across the street from the Capitol. They guarded access to this. They would only let Republican lawmakers in if they signed a confidentiality agreement, and only then would they show them their new districts. They claimed attorney-client privilege for the maps that they were drawing there because they were doing it in a law firm. You know, it didn't exactly follow that way. Courts did not like that. I mean, in Florida, where in 2010, voters passed fair districts amendments that said you can't use partisan information or partisan intent at all in drawing local legislative lines or congressional lines. What the Republican strategists there did was essentially set up a shadow redistricting process that funneled maps created by operatives using these same intense algorithms, and they funneled them into the public process under phony names of former interns who they created Gmail addresses in their names that that these people didn't actually have, or they would submit them under the names of their spouses or their neighbors. And in many cases, these exact maps would become the actual district boundaries. It was absolutely wild. So whenever these partisans of either side talk about how, oh, maps don't really matter, well, they spend an awful lot of time working to perfect these maps if they don't really matter. So it makes you wonder if they're being entirely on the up and up.
This affected, as you said, U.S. House races and many local legislative races. What about outcomes for the judiciary?
Oh, I think that's right as well. I mean, it's certainly been the case in fewer states, but this process has gotten knotted up in multiple levels and multiple ways. And you are beginning to see in many states that there's been just as much intensity placed on attempting to gerrymander races for state judgeships. You know, especially in North Carolina right now, there is a big debate going on over all of this. When a political party draws lines like this, it gives them a huge advantage.
I found myself wondering, and also trying to think back and remember, to what extent did the media actually cover this as a redistricting thing? I mean, I remember stories more about, you know, Tea Party and the emotional shift of Americans and things like that, when really it was kind of like a gaming of the votes, not the will of the voters. Did the media pick this story up in a significant way?
No, I think the media missed it entirely. And the Democrats missed it entirely, to be fair. So it's not as if it was only the media. But the media in general, I think, does a pretty poor job of covering redistricting. In part, this is because it's technical and they think it's boring and they think that readers will have their eyes glaze over and not pay attention. In part, it's because there are fewer state capitol reporters now than ever across the country, and that's a scary situation. In part, it's because political journalists think that gerrymandering has been around since the beginning of time, and that it's simply part of the process and it's politics as usual. Well, politics as usual changed in 2010. This was a different use of the gerrymander. We should probably call it by a different name. The technology is so different that these gerrymanders have proven more enduring and durable and longer lasting. And I still think that our media does a below average job of comprehending exactly how our politics has changed as a result of this. There's more talk of it than there used to be, but you still see an awful lot of coverage of, can the Democrats take back the House of Representatives stories, you know, both in the 2016 election, and now you're beginning to see an awful lot of them as we head towards the 2018 midterms. And often they simply don't mention the structural advantage that Republicans built in for themselves through redistricting. And it seems like a really important thing that we ought to be talking about. I mean, most analysts believe that in order to have a chance to take back the House in 2018, that Democrats are going to have to win somewhere in the ballpark of 54% to 55% of the overall two-party vote in order to even have a shot at it. And that is a pretty big advantage for the Republican Party. If you can hold a majority even when you face a wave going the other way, that is a danger for representative democracy. And I don't say that as a partisan. I say that as someone who thinks that our elections ought to be decided by the side that has the most votes. And what we have right now is something very different.
Yeah, I mean, basically what you're saying is if Democrats get 51, 52, 53, or even 54% of the vote, they still lose.
That is exactly right. And it was different last decade.
Yeah.
And that's what is so different in 2012 and onward on these maps. In 2006, in that big Democratic wave year, when Democrats took back Congress, they were able to do that with about 52.7% of the vote. The 2008 wave, a solidified Democratic control of the House, was won with just over 53% of the vote. The 2010 Tea Party wave, when Republicans took back the House, that was 51.7% of the vote. So you could have a wave with a majority. And what we're seeing now is that that's not going to be enough for the Democrats in 2018. We just had an election in Virginia in November of 2017. Democrats got about 225,000 more total votes for Virginia's State House of Delegates. Republicans, however, held on to control 51-49, even though Democrats got somewhere around 53 or 54% of the vote. Yeah. It was a 9-point advantage. I believe it was 53-44 as far as percentages of the two-party vote. So you can see right there that a 9-point swing, a 53% wave, it's not enough on these maps.
The Democratic Party appears to have been asleep at the switch in 2010. What about now?
They've woken up. They are aware of the importance of redistricting, and they are battling in all of these states to try to combat it. What you have is Eric Holder, the former attorney general, working on a plan along with former President Obama, and this is the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. And they are working on litigation, on ballot initiatives, and on trying to flip back chambers in their direction again. But it is an uphill fight. But I certainly think that Democratic leaders and donors are more aware of this problem than they were in 2010, and they're focused on trying to reverse it. On the other hand, if what they want to do is run a blue map and do the same thing back at the Republicans, that is not exactly good for a democracy either. And what you are beginning to see is just the pure weaponization of redistricting in all of these local races. So, I mean, back in November, there was a state Senate race in Washington state that was the difference between control of the chamber there. It was a Republican seat, and the Democrats, if they captured it, could win the Washington state Senate. They did. But that was a $9 million state Senate race. It is bad for our politics if our state Senate races begin costing so much money that normal people can't run and win in these districts.
And especially in the face of Citizens United, dark money, and the kind of money in politics problems we already have, I mean, it just exacerbates all of that. And meanwhile, actual citizens' lives are really affected by this gerrymandering. I mean, it's not just politics. It's about how people live and what happens to them.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You can see this most clearly in gerrymandered state legislatures. I think one of my favorite anecdotes about that involves Flint, Michigan, and the Emergency Manager Act that a gerrymandered legislature in Michigan passes, that voters undo it at initiative. And they say, we don't want the state to be able to have the power to go in and replace the local government. And the gerrymandered legislature overrides that initiative and says, we're going to do it anyway. And they go in and they replace the elected government in Flint, Michigan. And you end up with the poisoned water scandal. And kids actually died as a result of this. I mean, gerrymandering seems like it is technical, or that it's boring, or that it's about math, it's about maps. Really, it's about who represents us. Our district lines are the building blocks of our democracy. And when they get warped and twisted like this, it twists the very essence of democracy, and it twists outcomes, and it puts politicians beyond the reach of the voters at the ballot box, and it makes possible all kinds of situations that we were told in our civics class aren't possible.
And the whole thing then kind of turned into an out-of-control Frankenstein monster that toppled people whom it was supposed to protect, like Speaker of the House John Boehner, who nobody ever thought of as a moderate. But this is a system, when you have safe districts, it rewards extremists and punishes moderates, but only on the Republican side.
I think that's right, although I also think that it's had consequences for the Democrats as well. When you're packed into as few seats as that is possible, it tends to mean that, you know, safe Democratic seats elect a pretty liberal person, as well. So Democrats are kind of forced into becoming a little bit more extreme. But certainly it created a Frankenstein's monster on the part of the Republican Party. They created all of these uncompetitive districts that essentially put the angry base of the party completely in charge. In North Carolina, where Republicans redistricted the state in 2011 and took a state that had more Democrats in the U.S. House than Republicans, they were determined to create a 10-3 map, a map that resulted in 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats. And they did this by taking the city of Asheville, a pretty liberal town in the western mountain part of the state, and they cracked it in half. And they put half of the Democratic voters there into Patrick McHenry's seat, and they created a new seat that the incumbent there in Asheville, who was a conservative Democrat named Heath Shuler, looked at, and he said, "I can't win here," and he retires. That seat is now represented by Mark Meadows, who, as you know, is the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus and one of the most conservative people in the House. It's Mark Meadows who introduces the parliamentary motion of no confidence in the Speaker of the House that essentially leads to John Boehner's complete undoing. It's Mark Meadows who believes that, you know, Trump care is not conservative enough, and it essentially leads to the first undoing of the Republican health care bill earlier this year. And that's what happens when you draw districts like this. You go from a bridge builder, you go from a district that has changed hands in wave years at both sides, and you end up with a deeply unrepresentative district that sends somebody pretty extreme to Washington who has no incentive to listen to the other side at all.
When you look at racial gerrymandering, that's why we had the Voting Rights Act, to make it illegal to draw a district in such a way that an African-American person could never be elected. But that's not the case. We don't have those laws for partisan gerrymandering. There's a case before the Supreme Court, which hasn't been decided yet. Maybe you can tell us about that. But, I mean, is this legal? What kind of legal and political challenges have there been to this whole thing?
It's very complicated. There's two sets of case law. You can't do a racial gerrymander. You can, however, do a partisan gerrymander. And what lawmakers who have been pulled into litigation about the districts that they've drawn have tried to say this decade is, oh, no, no, we weren't doing a racial gerrymander, even though they consulted race data. This was a good old-fashioned partisan gerrymander, and that's just fine. So what we really need is for the Supreme Court to step in and create a standard on partisan gerrymandering, because if they do not, it will essentially undo all of the case law and all of the precedents on racial gerrymandering. So it could create a very dangerous situation there. Luckily, the Supreme Court has exactly that kind of case in front of them right now. It's a case out of Wisconsin. It's called Gill versus Whitford, and it arises from the maps that Republicans drew in that map room back in 2011 that created very advantageous maps for themselves in the state assembly. Indeed, in the first election run on those maps in 2012, Democrats got about 175,000 more votes. Republicans took 60 of the 99 seats. A handful of Democratic voters in the state brought this into the courts, and in the process of case after case and discovery, all of the draft maps and the emails and just the pure partisan intent that infected this process all came out. You had a 3-judge panel of the federal court last year say that this was an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander. It's the first time in decades that a court has said that and ordered new maps. The case went straight to the Supreme Court, which heard oral arguments back in October. Presumably, the 4 conservatives on the court appear to be against adding any standards here. The 4 liberals appear to be in favor of it. And Justice Kennedy, once again, is the swing vote. Justice Kennedy has said in the past he is open to a constitutional standard on partisan gerrymandering if it appears to be clear and manageable and focused and nonpartisan and easily applied by other courts in every case. And the question becomes whether he believes any of the sort of new mathematical standards that can determine when a gerrymander goes too far feel like they're convincing to him. It may well be our last chance for this standard. I mean, as Justice Kennedy has talked about, the retirement, you have a bunch of liberal judges on the court who appear not to be in the finest health, and you will have a Republican president and Senate likely to appoint and confirm new justices, you know, through 2020. So it seems unlikely that any additions to the court this decade will be in favor of a standard here. So this could very well be the final opportunity to get this under control, especially as we head towards the crucial 2020 races and redistricting in 2021.
For all the reasons that you've been talking about, when you published this book in 2016, it looked pretty much like there would be no contest at all in 2018. But you quote toward the end of the book this mastermind Republican strategist, Chris Jankowski, who said to you that the worst case scenario for the bulletproof Republican majority would be an unpopular Republican president who is in over his head. That's kind of what we have now. Do you think that might affect the upcoming midterm elections?
I think it most certainly will. I mean, if you look at the generic congressional ballot, a lot of the times you will see this being polled, and it is, would you prefer to have a Democrat or a Republican majority in the House? That question is now leading to a double-digit advantage for the Democratic Party. The question is, will that hold for another year, and will it be at a level that overcomes the structural advantage that Republicans have in these maps? Yeah. If Democrats need 54 or 55% of the vote, they're going to have to win the two-party preference vote by double digits. That's really, really hard to do. You know, it didn't happen in 06, it didn't happen in 08, it didn't happen in 10. It's been a long time since we've had the kind of election that created a double-digit advantage in the House vote. That's not to say it can't happen, but it is to say that 50% plus one is not going to be enough to make it happen. It's going to have to not only be a wave, it's going to have to be a tsunami. And what is most dangerous about that to me is that if 2012 repeats itself in 2018, and Democrats do get many more votes for the U.S. House, but not enough to take back the chamber, something pretty amazing will have happened in our politics. Republicans will control the White House, the U.S. Senate, and the U.S. House, all while garnering fewer votes in each of those institutions. And that just seems amazing.
Yeah, then you become not really quite a democracy. I think, was it you who wrote that we've been downgraded from democracy to flawed democracy?
Yes, there's a standard that Harvard University uses to rate the health and quality of a democracy. And by an awful lot of measures, especially in states like North Carolina, they've essentially said that the integrity of our district lines and the integrity of these elections are on par with Iran and Venezuela, which, you know, is not necessarily the kinds of countries you want to be in when you're talking about the quality of your democracy.
Now, the solutions to this, besides a vote against partisan gerrymandering from the Supreme Court, and we will see how that comes out probably in the new year, is one of the potential solutions is independent redistricting commissions, which some states have. And there's a sort of beautiful chapter in your book on Iowa where you feel like, you know, after having gone through the woods and being attacked by poisonous snakes and rabid animals, you come to a shelter of friendliness and good food or something. And that's Iowa, where they do really have a nonpartisan redistricting system that works. On the other hand, Arizona also has an independent redistricting commission that is highly politicized. How much of a solution is that?
You know, I think a commission can work, but they're only as good as the criteria that they are given to draw lines and the kind of people who are in charge of staffing them. I mean, in Arizona, you have an independent commission that is really a partisan commission, and it's very easily attacked and gamed by partisans. And I don't think it has done much to make elections there more meaningful or more competitive. In California, you have a much different process. You have a citizen-led process that I think did make many gains in 2012 as far as becoming a more inclusive and fair process. You actually saw incumbents lose, which you hadn't seen in California in a decade. I believe there had been one race in a decade in which an incumbent had actually lost. And in 2012, the combination of New Lines created, you know, a handful of defeats as well as a handful of retirements, and you got some new faces. But it hasn't necessarily stayed more competitive over the course of the last two cycles there. So if states can learn something from the experiences in Iowa and Arizona and California, and if they can design a commission that actually functions properly, then there's a real possibility there. It's certainly better than allowing partisans to run roughshod and completely choose their own voters. In Ohio, in Michigan, you are seeing some really, really interesting new proposals on commissions that, you know, might actually work. What excites me most is a proposal by Congressman Don Beyer of Virginia. And what he has put forth is something called the Fair Representation Act. And it involves a combination of multi-member districts, so larger congressional districts represented by 3 to 5 congressmen who would be elected by ranked choice voting. So that combination of districts that are harder to gerrymander and then voting for several people and ranking those choices essentially would go a long, long way in taking the extremism out of the system and making it possible for states like Massachusetts and Connecticut to elect Republicans again, making it possible for a Democrat to get elected from, you know, Kansas or Oklahoma, and bringing, you know, real bridge builders back. I think that if we want to do anything to fix gerrymandering, it has to involve fundamental structural reform.
You know, having read your book and thought about it, it seems like on the one hand, yeah, this is a partisan problem, a problem if not created, then brought to new levels of nefariousness and corruption by one party, the Republican Party. But on the other hand, the solution would really benefit both parties. And it would be not about elevating the Democratic Party, but about having multiple voices and stronger representation. I mean, more genuine representation.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that we are not going to have real change in these districts, I think, until Republicans realize what has happened to themselves over the course of this decade, largely because of these lines and the way that these districts have accelerated all of these kind of toxic trends of partisanship and polarization and extremism in our politics. And until they realize that good governing requires fair districts, and that fair districts are what we need to have if we want to incentivize politicians to compromise, to govern properly, to sit down together and to try to solve problems. I mean, all of the things that we consider crucial to the art of politics grow out of electoral incentives, you know? And when politicians are elected from uncompetitive districts and they have no reason to talk to the other side, they don't need the other side to win. Indeed, if they get a reputation as someone who is interested in talking to the other side or making compromises, they might earn themselves a primary challenge, and the primary challenge is the one thing that can actually beat them. We have to incentivize them to have different kinds of conversations and then to act differently when they get to Washington. And a different system and different kinds of districts is really the only thing that could do that.
David Daley is a journalist and author. His most recent book is Rat F***ed, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. Thank you so much for being with us.
A real pleasure. Thank you.
If you want to find out more about redistricting, you can go to fairvote.org, where David Daley is a senior fellow. And by the way, the title of the book, Rat F***ed, is actually a slang term for dirty tricks and sabotage in politics. It was used in the book All the President's Men by journalists Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. David Daley's book is beautifully written and very important if you care about democracy and want to take a look at what's under the surface. It's also available on audiobook. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. We'd love to hear your feedback, so please email us at feedback@radiocafe.org. Many thanks to the fabulous Dotfoil Computer Services of Santa Fe, providing top-notch computer service, sales, and more on the web at dotfoil.com. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our Northern New Mexico community, and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes and much more content of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.